Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles, recorded in our writer's studio just above the bookshop at Kilometre Zero in Paris. If you enjoy these conversations, there are a few different ways you can support us. First of all, you can leave a rating right now in whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings we get, the more likely it is that people will discover us. It only takes a few seconds and can really help spread the word. You can also buy books, gifts, and apparel from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, where you'll find our popular Year of Reading subscription, 12 books handpicked by our dedicated booksellers, shipped to you or a loved one wherever they are in the world. Finally, you can become a friend of Shakespeare & Company by joining the association we set up to get us through a difficult few years. Membership gives you access to exclusive online content, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Find out more at friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. I'll be back at the end, but until then, sit back and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. As a bookseller, recommending a novel, it can sometimes be useful to compare it to other books. That, however, is impossible for Checkout 19 by Claire Louise Bennett, because it's quite unlike anything I've ever read. It's a book about reading and writing and the physical presence and power of books, but it's also about class and the burning need many of us have felt to escape the life to which society tries to condemn us, tries to condemn women perhaps most of all. It's written with the astonishing combination of literary sophistication and lexical bawdiness that won Bennett so many fans and plaudits when her debut Pond was released. I'm so happy to get the chance to speak with Claire Louise Bennett about it today. Claire Louise, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Hello, Adam.
Hello, Claire Louise. I guess where I'd like to begin with Checkout 19 is on the subject of memory, or when I was thinking of how I would express this question, I was unsure whether to say memory or remembering, because it struck me that a lot of the tone of the book is the narrator, which may or may not be you. We'll come on to that maybe later, but is reaching back into her past and kind of unearthing these events. Some of them very distant, some of them perhaps not quite so distant. And this struck me as sort of, in a sense, of quite a different perspective to Pond, which in a way felt kind of more immediate. So I think where I'd like to begin is on the writing process of that. Was it something that you felt was sort of like a fundamental shift in perspective as a writer, sort of going from the sort of the more immediate, more sort of present feel of Pond to something a little more distant with Checkout 19?
So I think with Pond, there was like a deliberate move towards focusing on the immediate and what was to hand. And that was as a way of sort of extricating myself from academia. Mm-hmm. I'd been studying for a number of years. And I wanted to kind of get out of that way of maybe thinking. And so I stopped studying. But my brain was still very much functioning in that kind of very analytic, intellectual sort of way, which was hindering me creatively. Mm-hmm. Like in the long term, it was really beneficial, the stuff that I was looking at during my PhD, and a lot of the concepts and things relating to, say, selfhood and stuff, and representations of selfhood definitely fed into. But in terms of actually writing, producing words and sentences, I needed to unravel a little bit. So focusing on the immediate was really useful in that regard. Mm-hmm. So then when it came time for me to kind of put this book together, a number of years had gone by, and I suppose I was at that time in my life when I started to have a really distinct sense of having a past. up until that point, and certainly around the time I was writing Pond, my life felt all of a piece. Still, whereas now it definitely doesn't. I am aware of my past in a way where it almost seems like a different lifetime. Mm-hmm. So it made me kind of curious about past events and circumstances that some that I'd maybe overly prioritized, and then other things that maybe I hadn't really acknowledged very, very much. So, like, for example, I've lived in Ireland for just over 20 years now, and obviously from time to time I get asked why I came here. Mm-hmm. And I've always, I maybe guess, answered that slightly either facetiously or evasively. But most of the time I answer the question by saying, well, I came here really to get away from England, which is accurate, but it doesn't really explain very much. I guess it took me a while to really, well, I didn't really think about it too much myself, because like I said, it's just in that way, isn't it, where you just carry on with living, you're just getting on with it then, and the repercussions of that decision. So it's only recently that I've reflected on it, and then I think to myself, well, really, I know why I left. It's because I didn't really have much available to me, really, in the UK, in England, in terms of what I might do with my life. I didn't see that I had very many options. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying, I suppose. At that point, I think just before I left the UK, I'd been working in a warehouse, W.H. Smith warehouse, actually, mm-hmm. books. I was doing night shifts, and I preferred working in warehouses, to be honest, than office work, just because I guess you kind of move around a bit more. I really don't like sitting still for too long. So I suppose, yeah, things were kind of presenting themselves to me more fully, mm-hmm. than they had done for a while. I mean, I've got a very bad memory, actually. I've got a really bad memory. But I always see, and the way that this kind of started off, you know, the very, I think it's the first section, A Silly Business, mm-hmm. and it's told in the third person plural. Mm-hmm. Well, that I wrote that, well, that began anyway, very many years ago. And the first line of the original piece was, "We remember our first memory, don't we? Yes, mm. yes, yes, we do. But that's not the same thing as the first thing that happened, is it? No, no, it isn't. We don't remember what the first thing that happened is, do we? No, we don't." So it's acknowledging that there is that discrepancy between what we remember and then what the first things that go on. Mm-hmm. And then also in that piece, what I was allowing for was the possibility that at some point in my life, I might have an earlier memory. So mm-hmm. my first memory that I have now won't always be my first memory. I hope not. I hope I manage to get an earlier one so that my first memory kind of, and so I allow for the fact that hopefully that in my coming years I'll be able to remember maybe more and more. I was kind of interested in that idea too, the kind of the shift in terrain of it.
There's a lot in what you've just said that I'd like to explore, but it's interesting that you say you don't have a very good memory, because another writer who I've interviewed who said the same thing was Carl Ove Knausgård. Oh, and obviously your work in Checkout 19 and his work in his My Struggle series are very different books and very different projects. But as a reader, in a curious kind of way, they had, in at least one respect, a similar effect on me, which was to plunge me back into my own memories to kind of, I really felt like in sort of excavating your memories, your past, you were sort of allowing me to do the same. And I was trying to figure out what it might be about your work and what it might be about Knausgård's work that produces this similar effect. And I was wondering if it had something to do with this kind of acknowledgement of the sort of the fluidity and the sort of fluidity of memory and the sort of disintegration of memories. Because often when you read memoir or autobiography, and I, you know, Chekhov 90 could not be classified really as that in the sort of the strictest sense of the term, everything is presented as very concrete and very clear, and often with a quite a defined arc or quite a defined journey. Whereas what we find in Chekhov 19, I mean, there's a moment for where you say, you're talking about your jacket on one of the chairs, and you say, sometimes I see a green jacket and sometimes it's a purple one. And I think there's something in that, yeah, I guess that kind of acknowledgement that produced this effect within me. And so what I think, what I'd like to know in that respect is, was that, did you have to fight against that sort of expectation of solidity and coherence and fact while excavating these memories? Were you perhaps tempted to kind of concretize things whereas to you perhaps they weren't so concrete?
That's really interesting. There's a few things to think about there. No, I knew I wasn't attempting to write something like a memoir for a range of reasons. I know you haven't directly asked me that, but we're in that area, so I'll address it. As you say, a memoir presents life in quite a particular kind of a way. It feels the way it's written about. It feels like there's an inevitability to how things went, in a sense, one thing leading to another, as if it couldn't have been any other way to a degree. And there is a kind of almost, like you say, a definitive take on the significance and meaning of certain events, which I can't take on, because I don't feel that certainty. So it doesn't feel appropriate to work in that mode. And also, I think it does set up a different reading experience. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in what you had to say about how my book and Knausgård's invite this sort of participation. Mm-hmm. That's something that I very much wanted to happen. And I don't think that necessarily that's something that happens when you read memoir. I mean, I enjoy memoir, but some of the enjoyment comes to a degree from being quite passive. I find it quite a passive experience. And sometimes I do want to just be kind of passive. A lot of the time when I'm reading, it's a very active kind of engagement because of the books I tend to go towards. But every now and again, it's just kind of nice just to have this, you know, life play out in front of you. But it feels very contrived, weirdly enough, you know, when I read a memoir like that. It doesn't feel quite convincing to me, because I just haven't experienced, my experience of life hasn't been that way at all.
Well, I think one of the areas where it had this evocative effect most strongly for me was the sections when you're writing about school. And one thing that really stood out to me that set it apart from a lot of writing about school is that it didn't feel as if school was a time of infinite possibility to you. I think often in literature, possibly because a lot of literature comes from people who went to either private or public schools where sort of opportunity and everything is really stressed, or, you know, maybe from state schools, but very sort of middle class state schools where that sort of some of the, let's say, the rhetoric of opportunity was then realized in the future life. And one thing in Checkout 19 that really resonated with me was that sense of the, I don't know, almost not exactly the futility of the school experience, but almost like it was a joke being played on the kids. Like, you know, the teachers had the, you know, were going through the motions. They had the things they said about your work experience or your career plan, but they didn't really believe it for the kids they were teaching, and the kids didn't really believe it about themselves. And that struck me as something I don't think I've ever come across represented in a book before, and yet it was something that resonated enormously with me.
Oh, well, that's really interesting too. I didn't write it all from scratch. It came together last year during pretty much the first lockdown, which was pretty full on. And I was working with material and some of it had existed for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. I didn't know as I was writing it up or working with that material that the school thing was going to become what it did. Like, things just really, I don't know, they just sort of exploded and became so much more. I had these scrappy bits, you know, and I'd had these scrappy bits for quite a long time. And I was in London a couple of years ago trying to sort of work them out and put them together, and it just wasn't working. I don't know what it was, but there was something about just being at home and being stuck at home last year with these pieces that I was just able to, I don't know, really, I get into the, I don't know what it was. Anyway, another thing that's always very galvanizing, of course, is I guess I had some feeling of anger, like some anger had been kind of building up in me as well in the meantime. Like, I'd read that piece in The Guardian about working class students being bullied in universities, right? So we're talking about adults here, bullying other adults because of the way their voice sounds. Mm-hmm. Talking about privileged adults picking on, making other people feel bad, because even talk about it now, I can feel myself getting angry. Mm-hmm. So there was this anger. And that was apparent then as when I was writing. And it's funny too, because that's the point, isn't it? When you grow up in that kind of environment, the things that make you angry, you quickly make it in some way humorous as well. Uh-huh. That's the way of dealing with stuff, right? You almost immediately make it into something, like you said, a bit of a joke or just something. It's always kind of laced with some kind of humor, because what else are you going to do with it except, you know, go mad? Because it can be quite overwhelming, that feeling of injustice or inequality. So that really got to me reading that. And there were numerous, but they never really seemed to occupy that much space though in the media, and I find that really irritating. You know, you'll get this odd story kind of coming up every now and again in the back pages, and then nothing. It doesn't seem to get any traction, and I just think, well, these are clearly the same people who are running you know, the country effectively, and this is their mindset, you know. So that was definitely an aspect. And I guess when I was reading those pieces, I was reminded again of my own experiences and how naive I'd been, because I had thought for a while when I was at school that if I did knuckle down, I would do well, you know, and I would be able to do something interesting with my life, and that opportunities would open up. I kind of did believe that to a degree, because I knew I didn't want to stay where I was, and I didn't want to stay within that town or that place, or that I knew that I just didn't feel particularly comfortable there. Mm-hmm. So I kind of did, but it was impossible, and like that, it did feel kind of pointless, because classes were just so unruly a lot of the time. They were just buggering about so much, And after a while, it does get a bit like, oh, for God, it's not, it's annoying after a while. Uh-huh. It's just not that much fucking fun. and you just think, well, I just would rather be on my own than this, because this is kind of irritating. So I don't know whether my tendency towards solitude sort of occurred then, mm-hmm. but I did like just doing projects on my own and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So then there's that awakening, isn't there? Because she goes off and she does A levels, and she sort of realizes that really, actually, the schooling that she's received so far has been pretty flimsy, and the kids from other schools, because it was a college, right? I mean, we didn't have sixth form. My school did not have sixth form. That tells you everything, right? You're 16, you leave school, you get a job.
That's it for you.
Do you know what I mean? There was no sixth form. I went to a college in town, which was a completely different thing. And I was the only one from my school at that college. There was nobody else. I think a few mm-hmm. people went off and did BTECs maybe, or something like that in what was called New College. But it was quickly apparent that I was really quite behind in terms of reading and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting adjustment to have to make. And then I had to make another one when I went to London. And that wasn't so much to do with education, because by that time I had read a lot of books and I was a bit more confident of my ability, sort of intellectually, academically. Mm-hmm. But it was an awakening on a kind of a socio-economic level. Mm-hmm. I just saw for the first time rich people, and I'd not really seen, in those numbers, and just so obviously, hadn't seen wealth like that, and it was pretty shocking, really. I felt quite angry about that as well.
I'm conscious of the fact that, because a lot of our listeners are in the UK, and a lot of what you'll be saying will be very familiar to them. But I've also realized through speaking with people around the world that in some way there's something quite mysterious about the class system in Britain, in perhaps okay. in England more specifically. Other countries have their own iterations of it, and it's by no means, I'm not sure a classless society exists anywhere, but I think I can imagine sort of, for example, listeners in the United States, where often there's the myth of the American dream, you go out and get it, would be potentially quite baffled by the sort of the situation that you have just sort of outlined, which is this sort of sense of being almost a kind of a prisoner of the class in which you're mm. born. Mm. And which is not to say that there is not an escape. And indeed your escape in many ways was leaving the country, mine too. But I think there's something very, very particular, and particularly English, about this, this very stratified, very kind of fixed class system in a way, and this kind of and then the attitudes that it provokes depending on which level of society you're born into.
It's so entrenched. And I don't even think, people are even sort of consciously discriminating against people or bringing assumptions, but it happens all the time, I think. The minute someone opens their mouth, they're being interpreted and placed, absolutely. And there's a whole set of assumptions that come with it. And it's interesting, because in Checkout 19, because that, I mean, that reflects, I suppose, some of the ambiguity, right? Because I don't really know much about the working class world, you know, as it's typically represented, mm-hmm. right? So I didn't grow up on a council estate. I don't know, you know, none of my family were on benefits or unemployed, or we had quite a lot of money. We had a Volvo, you know, my parents wore barber jackets in the winter when we went for walks up Marlborough Forest. Do you know what mm-hmm. you mean?
Yeah.
Out, like from the outside, in fact, yeah, we had all the sorts of tropes and of a middle class life, right? But having those things, it doesn't make you, mm-hmm. it doesn't make you middle class. And that's what you kind of realize as well. It's not just about having the right sort of cultural signifiers or economic signifiers. What you kind of realize is, and I think that's the most frustrating thing, is what it really is about is connections and networks mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. You can have all the Volvos you want and you can live in a 6-bedroom house or whatever, but what they have, the currency that they have, are these connections mm-hmm. that have been there for however long. And it's very hard. It's very hard to get on without those. Wearing another girl's knickers wasn't something you just got on with. It sort of took over, like keeping a secret, and changed the texture of the day entirely. It was difficult to know what to do with them once you got home and could sprint upstairs to your bedroom immediately and open a drawer full of knickers and put on a spotless pair of your own. Some girls didn't want them back after, and other girls thought that if you didn't give them back, it was because you wanted to keep them, and if you wanted to hang on to a pair of another girl's knickers, that meant you were scavvy or peculiar. It was quite a complicated business. Added to which, I never really liked my mother knowing I'd worn another girl's knickers, and if I put them in the laundry basket, she'd notice them right away and want to know where they'd come from. My mother was very particular about where things came from and didn't like it very much if something or other just turned up out of nowhere. "Where on earth have these come from?" she'd exclaim, holding up a pair of Garfield pattern pants, for example, eye level and at arm's length between the tips of her fingers. My mother didn't like other people's things getting in with our things, and I thought there must be a good reason why she didn't, so I became very conscious of our things and of other people's things, and I was constantly amazed at the way other people didn't seem to be conscious of their things at all. They were very slapdash with their things, I couldn't help but notice, whereas it had been instilled in me to be very careful with mine. This disparity between how things were treated did mean that other people's things, which were frequently chucked about any old how, had a completely different aura from those things that belonged to me. Their things seemed cheaper, more disposable, and my things seemed rarer and much more valuable, practically irreplaceable, and I was distractingly terrified of losing or ruining them. Having said that, I had a terrible habit of dapping things down, of taking things off and leaving them behind in the grass, for example. Easy come, easy go, as they say. As my father often said in the hallway as I went on up the stairs, with that soupçon of chipper sarcasm that typically permeates the many pithy observations of the proletariat. Easy come, easy go, eh? My alleged couldn't care less attitude made this self-starting man turgid with disapprobation, while his native substance lit up and rejoiced at how little importance I placed upon having this, that, or the other. A conflict simmered on and on in my father. On the one hand, he was rightly proud of the progress he'd made in his chosen trade and of the top-drawer material comforts he was able to consistently provide his family with because of it. Yet on the other hand, he also felt like a bit of a mug for going along with it all, working and buying and working and buying, working harder and buying better. It was all a big game after all, wasn't it? He could see that. And it wasn't a game he was destined to come out on top of. He knew that, and the conflict roiled away in him on and on. It sometimes happened, of course, that somebody might have something even nicer than something of mine. I seldom experienced any jealousy about it, because in a matter of weeks, whatever it was they had would seem perfectly average. Whereas where my things were concerned, the more time that passed, the more precious they became. My mother, I began to realise, did in fact have an eye for the finer things in life and made it her business to choose exceptionally nice things for us all. I wouldn't say she was at all materialistic or avaricious, yet having nice things was important to her. Possibly because when my parents got married and I was born, the two events happening in quick succession, they didn't have any things, nothing at all. And as far as I know, nobody gave them anything. Nothing they wanted, in any case. They started absolutely from scratch. And so naturally it became important to have things. It helps make unexpected circumstances seem planned and even desirable. Things hold life in place. Like pebbles on a blanket at the beach, they stop it from drifting away or flying up in your face. Having nice things makes you feel like you're doing a good job and shuts everybody else up. There's nothing anybody can say to you so long as you have nice things all around you. They can't touch you. And as time went on, there were more and more nice things, lovely things. A white cotton jacket with striped lapels and big square pockets. And come September, a smart navy coat with two rows of small buttons and a rounded velvet collar. Party dresses with smooth sashes and oxblood loafers and argyle socks and a rosebud pitcher and bowl and croissants on Sundays and banana shampoo and maidenhair ferns and holidays in the Canary Islands and gold-plated bathroom taps and pavlova and 501s and flower fairies and wayfarers and feast ice creams and Slazenger tennis rackets and made-to-measure Roman blinds and Betty Boop sweatshirts and barber jackets and pineapple leggings and Wedgwood china, and stag mahogany, and Laura Ashley wallpaper, and rally racers, and bally shoes, and Clinique, and Volvo, and Thornton's, Easter eggs, and Chez Fred fish and chips. I had the same bed cover as Helena Bonham Carter. I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw the photograph in the Sunday Times magazine. She was sat on her bed with her immense hair all loose, and the rosebud cover on her duvet was exactly the same as the rosebud cover on the duvet that I was at that very moment sitting on myself. I would have liked to have torn the page out and slipped it into my rosebud pillowcase that was exactly the same as her rosebud pillowcase. It was intoxicating to look at a photograph of Helena Bonham Carter sitting on a bed that looked just like mine. It encouraged me to feel there wasn't a great deal of difference between us. As I gazed at her romantic mass of twinkling curls, I could feel my own sullen slew of rat's tails augmenting magnificently. Next to my bedroom was the bathroom, and one day, not long before I left home to go to university in London, a duck appeared on the bathroom wall just above the toilet cistern. I couldn't believe my eyes. Where had it come from? My mother had painted it. "What do you think?" she said. "Does it look daft?" It came all of a sudden, all at once, and brought with it a terrible wind. Soon after it arrived, all the nice things my parents had worked so hard to gather and had arranged so beautifully were blown right off the life they'd held so firmly in place, were wrapped up in newspaper and put into separate boxes. And some of those boxes went who knows where, and some of them ended up in my father's mother's loft, and nobody can remember what's inside any of them. All this time later, I find myself holding on to certain things I don't even like that much, for no other reason than that I have had them for so long. A somewhat tautological reason. On it goes.
There's a couple of books that have come out recently by young women writers in the UK. Three Rooms by Jo Hamyas, is it? Mm-hmm. And Anna Glendinning. An Experiment in Leisure. And they're both absolutely brilliant books that sort of detail how, I think both of them are about women, young women who have graduated from Cambridge. And like that, they don't have, you know, it's not a pathway to anything. Mm-hmm. because I think maybe one of them got there on a scholarship or something like that. So actually, after they graduate, one is renting a sofa in a flat. I'm not quite sure what the other one's up to, but it's such a heartbreaking read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're really bright, sharp women, and yet they're just clutching at hardly, and there's nothing there. They're not valued.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even seen, you know? It's insane. And you read that, and this is now, like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think actually when I was at university, it was probably better in many ways, because at least I was able to go to university.
Mm-hmm.
That's that time you didn't have to pay fees. You had to pay your maintenance grant. You know, you got poxy. My maintenance grant was poxy. But anyway, the point was, after I graduated, I went back to my hometown. And it was actually pretty much as though I hadn't done the degree. I may as well not have done it. Didn't lead to anything. Had no value whatsoever, you know? I mean, and I'm the only person in my family who has a degree. No one's bothered since. No one went before and no one's been since. Because it doesn't have any value.
Without the connections, it doesn't. Yeah.
It's a waste of time.
It's really interesting, I think, that the way you said that sort of you would not describe yourself as working class in the way that it is working class is typically presented, which I think is a sort of a particular bugbear of mine, is the sort of, it's almost like the authorized vision of the working class. So it's which again is authorized by the, you know, the middle class and upper class gatekeepers that often operate in certain sectors of, for example, the publishing industry. And so we have this sort of, this sense of like, if you're not from, you know, Birmingham or further north, if, you know, you're not part of a mining community, if, you know, your family is not beset by social problems and doesn't live in a council house, then you don't tick the boxes of being a sort of the acceptable face of the working class to the to the people who decide which books are going to get published and which books are going to get out there. So one of the things I found so particularly refreshing about Checkout 19 was this was sort of a presentation of again, well, in my family we used to jokingly call the kind of the upper working class, this kind of, you know, it's with a certain
I thought that was a real term for a while, actually.
With a kind of dry irony, you know, but like it's that sense of the sort of the, as you say, the sort of the working class come from families who don't have university education, who maybe left school at 16, got jobs or apprenticeships, and then their kids have been brought up with this idea of aspiration, getting on in life. They do all the things they're told they're supposed to do. They tick all the boxes they're supposed to tick, and yet, as you say, then you end up back in the hometown without the, you know, the fabled doors opening for you as you had been kind of promised by the by the life as it was set out for you.
Yeah, and I you know, another aspect of that as well is that then I think there is maybe that expectation, if you are a writer from a working class background, you are going to write about working class life. Mm-hmm. And in a very realist sort of way, this sort of gritty kind of realism and stuff, which I don't write like that. But there is, I think, very much an assumption that that's what a working class writer kind of does, and that's their world, and somehow they can't extend beyond that or something. I don't know, and that's why I found, you know, a writer like Anne Quinn, the 1960s writer Anne Quinn, just so powerful and interesting and inspiring. She was from a working class background. She's brought up by a mum. I don't know what her dad was up to. I think he was sort of maybe around off and on. She was born in Brighton, but always had just a sense of life as being something really quite, like, almost sort of, what's the word, cosmic or something. Mm-hmm. Like, she wanted a different scale of existence. And I remember that feeling, and it's probably something a lot of us feel when we're younger. And then it all gets kind of narrowed down sort of quite kind of quickly. Mm-hmm. And then you think, oh, wow, okay. And then it's that phrase, isn't it, keeps coming up. When are you going to get on with it? Uh-huh. When am I going to get on with what? You know, get on with it. Oh, all right. God. So it all gets kind of, yeah, whittled down to this very sort of narrow life path very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't up for that. I know I wasn't up for that at all. And it is that kind of desire to, I suppose, want to kind of remain, I don't know, open and in touch with everything and, you know, like possibility and energy and whatever it is, you know, just that, I don't know. And that's what fueled her imagination and the way she writes. So in her work too, there's a lot of detail about working class domestic environments. Great kind of quite strange, very sort of, what would you call them? Just very unusual descriptions, I suppose. And then which led her to being compared not very in a not very kind of flattering way to the nouveau roman writers. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time she was kind of seen as just being imitative of that particular genre.
Yeah,
which was mean and again reveals a sort of a class sort of blind spot in a way. Mm-hmm. That they couldn't, critics at the time couldn't really see that she was coming from, her writing, the way that she wrote was coming from an authentic place. Mm-hmm. This fascination with what objects are and what they stand for. There's that duality, I think, in her work. It's got that phenomenological kind of dimension to it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she knows those sort of cliche kind of working class sort of, you know, the B&Bs and the bars. Mm-hmm. And there's just the stuff they always have. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit. But yeah, so I just love that she goes beyond that. And mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure how she does it, actually.
Yeah. I think it's very telling that it's only really in the last few years that sort of she's getting anything like the recognition that her talent deserved. Like, it's only, and that again, only because of the sort of the dedication and the kind of persistence of a few people and you know, and a few, one or two publishing houses.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of, it's almost like, yeah, as you said, the critics at the time didn't know what to do with her. And they had that very kind of patronizing, sort of, oh, it's sort of sub nouveau roman kind of approach, which I think underlined their inability to, to recognize the originality and the authenticity of what she was doing. That, as you say, it comes from a sort of, it comes from a very natural place in her, but that the sort of the radars of the kind of critical establishment weren't tuned into in some way. But in fact, one thing that you do throughout Checkout 19 is sort of bring in books and bring in writers. Like I said in the introduction, that it was in many ways a book about books, and that's sort of that's the reading of books and the writing of books, and we'll come on to the writing in a bit. But it's quite fun, actually, the range of authors that you sort of that you draw in and that you, I guess, show your connection to, or show how they've kind of shaped you. One of the ones that struck me particularly, and I think this in a way very much places us in a similar sort of generational spot, is the studying of A Room with a View for A-level. And, you know, the episode where you sort of, get so sort of, at first don't know what to make of this book, and then get so sort of caught up in it that with a few friends you book a kind of a trip to Florence to try and sort of channel the the forces that are present in this book. But it's I think it's also, it also stood out to me because in a way it's sort of unlike someone, you know, someone like Quinn. This is maybe a book one might not expect somebody writing from the particular kind of class position that you have been to necessarily connect to. And then there was something something really powerful and really universal in certain elements of the book that sort of threaded their way into your mind and into your personality.
Well, I think there can be a kind of a tendency, as a working class person, to have sort of quite romantic ideas about literature anyway. Like I do have a sort of a, there's a deep sort of contradiction in me in many ways, because I can't stand systems of privilege and so on, but I really enjoy quite, you know, a good costume drama at the same time. You know what I mean? No, I won't watch the, what's that royal one? What's it called?
The Crown.
No, I won't watch that. That's just poor shit. But I do like, you know, and I love the, and I love the clothes, and I love, you know, I love a Merchant Ivory film. And then I get really annoyed afterwards and I just think, oh God, you know. And I'm disgusted with myself as well. But it is that kind of, it has that romantic idea, and even writing and being a writer is sort of fulfilling something that seems just very romantic in a way. Mm-hmm. And it is. I can't pretend that I'm really changing the world. I think there is something sort of intrinsically romantic about it. But at that age as well, I mean, she's reading what, Sidney Sheldon and Jackie Cutler. So it's all kind of, I just don't think that at that stage, class discrepancies and discriminations were obviously forefront in her mind. Mm-hmm. She's looking more than anything to understand or feel out or inhabit these very strong emotions that are going on. And literature is, of course, one of the ways by which we can do that. So that's just something that Forster just achieved so well with that particular book. It's so beautiful, really. Mm-hmm. And very funny. It is, I reread it recently, it's actually very funny as well. And again, it hints at this different scale of living. Mm-hmm. You know, it's beauty and love and courage all capitalized, you know. Mm. It's always so exciting and thrilling, isn't it, when you read a book and you see those, now it just looks kind of cranky and weird, but years ago it just, you know, it was like this absolute kind of, you know, the platonic idea of these qualities or forces. Mm. You know, so yeah, she's very much taken up with this idea then of taking herself out of Wiltshire, Swindon, Wiltshire, and going to Florence. And then of course they meet a guy from just down the road.
But I think there's one thing I mean, obviously, Room with a View and Check Out 19 are very, very vastly different books. And yet I think there's one thing that they have in common is, and this connects to what you were just saying, is kind of sincerity, I think. Like when you read Forster now, and particularly, I think, Room with a View, there's something I think, yeah, very, very charming about the seriousness and the sincerity with which he approaches life and approaches thoughts and approaches certain concepts. And that struck me also with Checkout 19. Like there was sort of it felt like, not that it's a particularly sort of revealing book, but there's still, it felt like it was coming from a place of sort of utter sincerity, which I think is quite a difficult thing to sustain, actually. And, you know, often books will kind of lapse into sincerity for a short while. And then sort of, you know, they're often the sort of the chapters or the paragraphs or even just the sentences which really leap out. But I think this sort of, yeah, this sort of sustained sincerity throughout an entire 200-300 page book is very rare. And it struck me, I wonder if as a writer it's kind of quite exhausting in a way.
No, I didn't. I didn't find it exhausting at all. I found it quite energizing. I think sometimes you can be maybe a bit fearful of that. Maybe particularly in recent years, I think there's been a sort of quite an ironic stance, perhaps. Maybe a kind of a, not a fear, but maybe, I don't know, sort of a reluctance maybe to come across as sincere. I don't know, even the word, it seems so, in a way, gauche or something. I don't know, weirdly. But I think what was going on with it, I just kind of wrote whatever seemed to, I just wrote what mattered to me. And that was kind of, that was kind of a bit of a revelation. So in that sense, yeah, it was quite energizing and quite, and feeling, experiencing that that willingness and that openness to do that was really quite exciting in some way. So I went with it, and things were kind of coming up and things were coming into it, and you know, I didn't have a plan for it or anything like that, and I didn't really know why I was writing the certain things I was writing. I didn't know what the function was of them or whether they related to another piece of it or anything like that. I wasn't really that worried particularly about that kind of thing, because I kind of trust that maybe there's a reason why something will come up, and it will come, you know, it will just become apparent to me when I'm a good bit into it. I just felt like sticking to things that seemed to me to kind of matter, really.
I think that idea of sort of things coming together is really apparent in the book. Like it's odd because it's sort of in certain ways it feels like quite a sort of a disparate collection of memories or events or thoughts, and yet as you make your way through the book, you do feel it kind of hanging together. And yet, and I've read it three times now, and like the thing, I still can't quite identify what that thing is. It's almost like it's not one thing, but a kind of a series of sort of interdependencies between the different episodes and the different, I don't like the word themes, but you know, whether it be sort of class or writing or womanhood or things like that, that sort of, they work in sort of equilibrium with each other. It's not sort of like each section has one particular thread which all get tied together at the end, but there's something, yeah, there's this kind of this sort of overall equilibrium at work.
Yeah, I mean, so with that, I think I kind of create a sort of a maybe connective tissue or something in a very, on a very intricate kind of level. I love when I've pretty much got all the pieces sort of together and I know what's going to be there. And then I need to kind of, yeah, just work out how they're going to kind of sit with each other. That's the part that it's almost sort of like sculpting or something. That's the part I really, really enjoy. It's a helicopter. It's quite loud. you'll have that by the sea. And I mean, one of the things that I really love then is I feel like I kind of go in then. I go into it with a little kind of toolkit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it is like engineering or something. And there'll be real kind of small motifs or just sort of qualities or that I can kind of really bring out and create kind of links with or riff on or echoes or like the idea of hot and cold. That hot and cold kind of run throughout it and references to it in various different ways. So I think if you're working kind of on that level, it's almost like you're kind of underground. You're in the you're in the basement, kind of tinkering with the foundations and the pipe work, and then that's going to give the what's above it overall a sense of cohesiveness.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what you mean?
Yeah, no, very much so. And I think one of the areas where that kind of comes across, I guess, in the most kind of one of the most satisfying ways, perhaps because the section itself feels to begin with so utterly unlike other sections in the book, is, now you're going to have to let us know the pronunciation of this because there's been some debate about whether it's Tarquin Superbus or Tarquin Superbus. What a
Superbus. Superbus, that's quite funny. I say Tarquin Superbus.
Okay, good. Okay, I feel vindicated.
What do you say?
Superbus, obviously.
Superbus, that's really good.
So, I mean, it's sort of, I'm not sure necessarily we would have the time to go into the full, you know, the full explanation of this section. And I just recommend that our listeners go ahead and read it. But this is essentially as a writer, you're revisiting a story that was written many years previously, and without giving too much away, let's say without any direct access to the original story.
Right.
And I think there was something really fascinating about that as a reader, actually, just sort of seeing what a writer maybe, I guess, sort of 20 or so years down the line would make of a story that they sort of remembered or half remembered from the sort of an earlier stage in their life as a writer.
Yeah, that was funny, that section, because I had envisaged that maybe being maybe a couple of paragraphs long or something. Again, I wasn't really sure what I was doing when I embarked upon that particular piece, that did just start with, yeah, many years ago I wrote a story about a kind of an aristocrat. He's not aristocratic, I don't think. Not, he might have notions towards that, but anyway, he's a very wealthy man. And then Yeah, I don't know. It was supposed to be, it was only supposed to be a couple of paragraphs anyway. Oh, that's what I thought. I thought, I don't know what I'm writing about this. This isn't going to really get me anywhere. And then, yeah, it just, it kind of came. Well, then, yeah, this idea of come to life. I was sort of playing with that idea in a way, and that idea of like, well, how do you write in that vein? You know what I mean? So here is a character, you know, people will know from my first book and from previous interviews that I'm not a character or plot oriented sort of writer. So this is a kind of a rare thing, actually. And it's not surprising that I do look back on it and think, God, once upon a time, I did write, you know, mm-hmm. or begin to write at least a story that had a character with a name, very positive name. But it is actually the name of, I think it was, he was the last Roman emperor. There was actually a Tarquin Superbus. And I had completely forgotten that. But after, not that long ago, I thought about it. And I thought, where did you get Tarquin Superbus on? That is so weird. Is that a name? Like, is Superbus a name? And I Googled it and it comes up. And I was like, well, where, how did that come into my brain then? And that's another, you know, that's another bizarre mystery of like how things get into our brain and how they come out again. And then you completely forget the origin. And then what happens with that piece is, and you probably did notice it as it went along, was that he kind of shifted character a little bit. His character was a little bit unstable. Like to begin with, he seemed like just a kind of a stereotypical kind of, you know, European 19th century kind of chap. And then he grows a bit more in Wonder Woman. But then she changes her mind about, you know, and it's kind of shifting and unstable. And I was interested in that because I thought, well, what is it like to spend time with a character? Mm-hmm. You know, you often hear authors talking about it, and I've never really had that experience at all. So it was interesting to spend time with that. And I thought, well, probably then what they need to do is, do they go back then and change some of the things at the beginning so that there is this kind of continuity? Whereas I don't. And there are obvious, and with the Doctor as well. I mean, the Doctor ends up being completely different almost to how he starts off. And she kind of, it's like she kind of fancies him in the end. You know, she's always created him into something that's quite attractive. Whereas he starts off being almost vampiric. You know, he's like 300 years old and white. And then the next, you know, towards the end, it's only in a matter of pages, he becomes like, he's got this really lovely suit on and he smells really fragrant. And in my mind, actually, at this stage, I didn't put it in the book, but in my mind at this stage, he looked a bit like the guy out of the Grand Blitzer. I can't remember the name of the guy he played, the actor. But that's how he... So he'd gone from, like, Nosferatu to, like, this, you know, gorgeous 60-year-old Italian kind of guy. And it's amazing. And I just think through the process of writing, all that transformation was going on. But I think that's probably why it'd be absolutely useless to write a conventional novel, because it'd just be changing the whole time in my head. And then
maybe you put your finger on something. I was going to say, maybe you put your finger on something about why sort of a lot of books seem to be kind of populated with kind of unnaturally beautiful characters. It's because, you know, you said about writers spending time with their characters. It's like, you know, you start off as Nosferatu. It's kind of, I don't want to spend time with this guy.
Maybe,
a 60-year-old Italian dandy.
And then I ended up, and then he goes off, doesn't she? And she's like, oh, and you, Doctor, and you, I could have listened to you all night long. You know, like, I got a crush on my own creation at this stage. It's like, it's pretty far up. And then, of course, in that story as well, the original story, there was no female character. Mm-hmm. And then in the retelling of it, one creeps in. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I think she's referred to as a housekeeper and then a maid. And then it's all the same person. But, you know, it's just, oh, there's another thing there. You know what I mean? And it's not defined or particularly designated yet. And then as it goes on, she acquires a name all of a sudden. She's Rosalia. And I was very interested in that too, because then I thought, well, should I have gone back and changed all the, you know, vague kind of references to her and made them more. But I was interested in showing, I suppose, how a story develops mm-hmm. in the imagination.
Yeah,
and
how
it grows and shifts, and so I wanted to keep that in, really.
Yeah. And I think that brings us on to I think probably the last thing we're going to really have time to talk about. But is the sort of the a lot of times during this conversation, I've mentioned things that sort of that really chimed with me, that really resonated, that I could very much identify with. But of course, there's one strain of the book, which for relatively obvious reasons was sort of quite alien to me, was that sort of the experience of womanhood and the experience of being a teenage girl, the experience of being of becoming a woman, of being a woman who writes as well, and the kind of reaction that sometimes provokes in certain men, particularly men with whom you may be in a relationship with, for example. And coming back to sort of the first moment where I remember coming in and having read the book and talking about it with a few of my colleagues who had also read it, and all of them just happened to be women. And one of the things that they all immediately identified was the frankness and the accuracy with which you talk about having your period at school, and the sort of the description particularly of the kind of the period blood and the color of it, and how I can't remember the exact quote, but how like the color was so perfect that you wanted to take it into a makeup counter and ask for this particular shade. And it was fascinating to me to see, you know, I read that as a sort of an interested and entertained man, like male reader, and it was really interesting for me to hear from my colleagues how those sections felt so refreshing and so sort of new. I get to have this kind of, not so much the frankness, I guess, but the kind of the accuracy and the sort of the idiosyncrasy with which these experiences were represented.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very pleased to hear that. I think what was going on there.
I realise I didn't ask you a question, so my question could be, what was going on there?
No, you didn't. It said some nice things to me. Well, what was going on there? Well, I was thinking about the fact that I won't go on having periods like forever, obviously. And I quite like them for some reason. I do quite like them. And what happened was, I think, for years and years, I used tampons, and then I didn't want to use them anymore. And that was quite funny, because I thought, when did I ever really decide to use tampons? I can't really remember. Like, you just sort of did it, and that was that. And I guess I got curious then, because it seems like such an important decision, such an intimate decision in a way, about how you're treating your body, or and what you're putting into your body, and how you're thinking about what's happening with your body, like month after month, year after year. And it's like trying to minimize this occurrence and make it invisible. I wanted the visibility of it in a way. I wanted to experience it. I wanted it to be more apparent that I was having my period, you know? And there's just always this thing. And I remember, I'm sure many people of our age remember, you know, those adverts for like body form and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like this idea that your life doesn't have to stop and you can carry on like playing frisbee and riding horses. But maybe you just don't want to, do you know what I mean? Like, maybe you just don't flipping feel like it. And there's just this thing of everything carrying on as normal and it not being anything. Like, it didn't have to register in any way or change. And actually, that's a real shame, because your menstrual cycle is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And if you kind of tune into it, it can be really helpful to tune into it big time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're pretending it's not there, and if you think it's going to disappear just by putting a tampon in, like, that's just dumb. That's just not how it works. So, you know, it's all going to still go on, you know, all the hormones, all the rest of it. Then, you know, that's not going to stop just because you can't see the blood anymore. It's a very weird way of treating it and thinking about it. So, I guess once it started to become sort of more visible and I started to kind of like get into it and be like, oh, wow, I bled a lot these last few hours, or, oh, I haven't really bled that much. What's going on? Or whatever it might be. Or look at the color and you notice the color's changing and all kinds of stuff. It's just, yeah, you just think, God, this is a really important part of our experience. And so, yeah, I don't go in, I didn't want to make a big thing out of it or anything particularly. But I do remember leaking at school. And that's another part of, I guess, being a female too.
But I think that's a very important point there, which is like, yeah, you didn't want to make a big thing of it, but, you know, just it sort of, you needed to, or you wanted to represent it nonetheless. And I think that's a sort of something which feels very sort of indicative of Checkout 19 generally, actually. It's like it's, and there are certain sort of incidents which, let's say, other writers might make a bigger deal of in the in the context of the book. But I think there's something very in a way, maybe it comes back to the sincerity again and this kind of honesty that this is sort of things are often sort of presented. They're not necessarily sort of centralized in a narrative, but they're given the sort of, they're given voice to in a way that, in a sort of, I guess, at a degree which is kind of uncommon. It's almost like you're given two choices, which is the kind of, I guess, the body form choice, which is not to talk about it at all, or making it the sort of the central, you know, underlying sort of thrust of the narrative. Whereas one thing I think Checkout 19, you do very well with Checkout 19, is to have this sort of, I don't know, it feels like a sort of a very sort of well-balanced, very kind of, yeah, things presented maybe at the level of which you experience them in your life, I guess.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's good, actually. Yeah, I can't put it better, actually, than that. It is at the level that you experience them, and that's how, yeah, I want it to appear on the page, really. No more and no less. And it can be tricky trying to find a way of doing that and of including those parts of experience. But yeah, I like that. I'm going to remember that. Thank you.
Oh, no, thank you. And, I feel bad about leaving this interview on you giving me a compliment. So I will just say that if it hasn't come across, I'm sure it has to our listeners, but just what a remarkable achievement I think Checkout 19 is. I think it's, as I said in the introduction, quite unlike anything I've ever read before, and I would I'd press it on all of our listeners to get hold of a copy, which luckily they can do from the Shakespeare and Company online shop, in store obviously, or in your neighborhood independent bookstore, wherever that may be. And I guess all that remains for me to say, Claire Louise, is adieu. I could have listened to you all night.
Brilliant.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Since you've made it this far, I hope that means you've enjoyed what you've heard and will consider rating us in whatever app you're using. The theme music is Mr. Ginger by the incredible jazz musician Alex Freiman, taken from his album Play It Gentle. I'll be back next week. Until then, take care, happy reading, and thanks again for listening.